There was also some good news out of the Supreme Court, because today the court upheld Obamacare again. The court decided that Texas did not have standing to sue because nobody was forced to pay a penalty for not getting insurance. Why is that? Well, back in 2017, the GOP-controlled Congress passed a bill cutting the individual mandate penalty to zero. The Republicans' previous attempt to kill Obamacare killed this attempt to kill Obamacare.
The Affordable Care Act survives another Republican attempt to strike it down. This time, it wasn't even close. The question is, and I think there's an answer, is Obamacare here to stay? Plus, Democrats make progress on a critical voting rights bill as Senator Joe Manchin's proposal gets a key endorsement. The question is, will it get enough Republican support to overcome a filibuster? Let's see, we've got an answer to that, too. And two of the biggest names in tennis withdraw from Wimbledon. The question is, will we see them at the Olympics? It's way too early for this. Good morning and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that's serving up a busy hour of news ahead. I am Casey Hunt on this Friday, June 18th. We will start with the news. A conservative-dominated Supreme Court yesterday dismissed the latest attempt by Republicans to eliminate Obamacare, leaving intact insurance coverage for 31 million Americans. By a vote of 7-2, with Justice Stephen Breyer writing for the majority, the case was dismissed on basically the procedural basis of lack of standing. The court held that a Texas-led coalition of GOP-controlled states, as well as two individual plaintiffs, hadn't suffered any injury, and therefore they had no right to bring a lawsuit. Trump appointees Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett voted in the majority on a ruling that leaves in place the entirety of the Affordable Care Act. Justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch dissented. Yesterday's ruling was the third time that the Supreme Court has effectively saved the law. The first was back in 2012 by a vote of 5-4, when the court held that the penalty for not having insurance is a tax that Congress is entitled to levy. The second Supreme Court ruling came in 2015, when, by a vote of 6-3, they allowed the government to provide tax subsidies to the underprivileged to buy health insurance. The law has also survived in Congress. A GOP-led House passed 63 different measures over 6 years to either repeal or severely restrict the ACA, according to a 2016 Newsweek report. Only one narrowly made it through the Senate in 2015 and was, of course, vetoed by President Obama. But in July of 2017, with Donald Trump in the White House, Republicans were poised to enact what they called a skinny or slimmed down repeal of Obamacare. But in this famous moment, the late Arizona Senator John McCain cast the deciding vote against it with that thumbs down that brought applause in the chamber. Obamacare, it seems, now here to stay. All right, let's go to this now. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin's voting rights compromise has received a significant endorsement. Voting rights advocate Stacey Abrams says she largely supports the proposal.
What Senator Manchin is putting forward are some basic building blocks that we need to ensure that democracy is accessible no matter your geography. And those provisions that he is setting forth are strong ones that will create a level playing field, will create standards that do not vary from state to state, and I think will ensure that every American has improved access to the right to vote despite the onslaught of state legislation seeking to restrict access to the right to vote.
Senator Manchin released his proposal earlier this week, and it includes some Republican priorities, including voter ID, potentially opening the door to compromise on the Democrats' top voting bill. However, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is already rallying Republicans to oppose Senator Manchin's proposed voting rights compromise.
You all have noticed that there's now a debate among Democrats over a revised version produced by one of the Democrats yesterday, which has been endorsed by Stacey Abrams. So I would make this observation about the revised version: equally unacceptable, totally inappropriate. All Republicans, I think, will oppose that as well.
And Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, who is the ranking member on the Senate Rules Committee, slammed the endorsement that this proposal got from Stacey Abrams.
Well, we all, I think every one of us looks for opportunities to work with Senator Manchin, and we found those opportunities. I actually think when Stacey Abrams immediately endorsed Senator Manchin's proposal. It became the Stacey Abrams substitute, not the Joe Manchin substitute.
There you go. As for how Senate Democrats view the bill, they met Thursday afternoon to try and figure out a way to pass it through the Senate. Senator Manchin says he spoke quite a bit during the meeting and that Democrats made, quote, a lot of progress. Senators Raphael Warnock, Brian Schatz, and Amy Klobuchar all told reporters after the meeting that they wanted to move forward with the bill and that things were going in the right direction. As for what happens next, the Senate is set to vote on this on the bill this Tuesday, or at least on the procedural motions to start this process. However, Republicans are likely to block it unless Democrats find 10 Republicans to bypass the filibuster. And I think we've already answered that particular question. Joining us now, author of The Washington Post's early morning newsletter, Power Up, Jacqueline Alemany. Jackie, good morning. It's always good to see you. Thanks for being here. This voting rights bill, it's one that, you know, when we were looking at what Senator Manchin had laid out, you know, there are certainly are some things in it that many Democrats don't necessarily want to see behind the scenes. You know, I think that they are trying to or how to put it. They don't necessarily want to put some of the limits in that Joe Manchin is including in his compromise proposal. He has also added some things like voter ID that typically Republicans are supportive of. But somewhat ironically, Stacey Abrams coming out and saying, yes, let's do this, has given Republicans clearly the cover that they feel they need to just say no, absolutely outright. And I don't see a path for this going forward to get 60 votes. What's your reporting say?
Yeah, Casey, as you pointed out, all roads lead back to the filibuster here. McConnell and Roy Blunt's comments yesterday all but guarantee that Republicans are going to filibuster this sweeping voting bill. And Stacey Abrams giving Joe Manchin's compromise this stamp of approval further guarantees that, as she's become really a boogeyman that Republicans have relied on recently when pointing to the Democrats' so-called push, as Republicans have deemed it, to allow fraudulent voting, which has not been borne out by any facts or substance, despite Republicans attempted and repeated tries to try and prove that. But look, Senator Joe Manchin did suggest that he's open to starting debate next week. He said, I think we would all want to do that. So I think we're going to see that these differences being aired in real time with his fellow Democratic senators, which for them, at least right now, is a step forward, at least towards getting to that Republican filibuster and then taking it from there.
So, Jackie, I mean, one of the things that also surfaced this week, there was some leaked audio of Joe Manchin talking to a group of donors where he did address the filibuster question and seemed to express some openness to potentially changing it, which is, of course, at odds with his public comments on the matter. What role do you think this voting rights process, the fact that it is likely Republicans are simply going to straight up block it, could play in affecting his thinking? I mean, is this something that could help convince Joe Manchin that, you know, actually these Republicans that I want to be seen talking to are not acting in good faith?
Yeah, Casey, that article that you just mentioned, reported by The Intercept yesterday, was a fascinating leaked tape showing Joe Manchin trying to explain to some billionaire donors that if he was able to convince some Republicans who voted against establishing a January 6th commission to investigate the insurrection on Capitol Hill, then they could potentially, stop with this filibuster debate and hold off and move on to show to the liberal flank that Republicans are, in fact, acting in good faith. Joe Manchin has said that he told these donors that this January 6th commission was sort of a microcosm, specific action that Democrats were using to show that there was no way for Democrats to work with Republicans moving forward, and the example of why the filibuster needs to go. But as it regards to voting rights, you know, I think there's a lot of pressure being put on Manchin right now. Every single interest group is traveling to Capitol Hill to meet with him to try to change his mind on this, from the NAACP and the most prominent Black voting rights groups, along with the Texas Democratic state legislator who traveled here from Texas this week and met with Vice President Kamala Harris. There is a lot of pressure. This is going to be a galvanizing issue going into 2022. It's something that Republicans have seized on. So I think at the end of the day, you know, does Manchin want to be a good soldier for the Democratic Party or continue to be the lone holdout here and perhaps stall the entire Biden agenda? It's a calculus that I think we'll see play out next week.
Yeah, well, and probably for the rest of the year as well. The Washington Post's Jacqueline Alemany, thanks very much for being up early with us. We really appreciate it. And still ahead here, two of the biggest stars in tennis withdraw from Wimbledon. Plus, Juneteenth officially becomes a national holiday. We'll have those stories and a check on your weather when we come right back.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Up night for Jeffrey and Giannis in transition. Through the contact. Count it. Connaughton catch and shoot three. Halfway down and out. And Antetokounmpo. Oh! Flex on him, Giannis.
Oh, Milwaukee's Giannis Antetokounmpo driving the Bucks to a 104-89 win over the Nets last night and forcing Game 7 in the Eastern Conference semifinal series set for tomorrow night in Brooklyn. All right, to tennis now. The oldest Grand Slam tournament in pro tennis will be held without two of the sport's biggest stars. Both Naomi Osaka and Rafael Nadal say they won't compete at Wimbledon later this month. A statement from Osaka's agent yesterday says the second-ranked woman in the world is skipping the major to, quote, take some personal time with friends and family. It follows Osaka's withdrawal from the French Open in the wake of controversy over her decision to skip mandatory media sessions because of anxiety. Meanwhile, two-time Wimbledon champ Nadal will miss competition at both the All England Club and next month's games in Tokyo. Writing on Twitter, he'll take time to recover, quote, after listening to my body. Wish him all the best. Meanwhile, American Simone Manuel, the first black woman to win an individual swimming gold medal at the Olympics, won't get a chance to defend her title in Tokyo after failing to meet the 100-meter freestyle finals, failing to make the 100-meter freestyle finals at U.S. Olympic trials last night. Meanwhile, 12-time medalist Ryan Lochte is one 200-meter individual medley away from qualifying for his fifth games. If the 36-year-old finishes first or second in tonight's final, he'll become the oldest male swimmer to make an Olympic team. Wow. All right, let's turn now to Major League Baseball. One day after the league eased coronavirus restrictions for vaccinated players and staff, L.A. two-way sensation Shohei Ohtani took the mound in front of the first full-capacity crowd in Anaheim since 2019 on what was dubbed reopening day at Angel Stadium. Ohtani struck out five batters, allowing just one run on five hits and a walk over six innings of work. The Angels preserved his win with a five-run seventh inning capped by Taylor Ward's grand slam. They go on to defeat Detroit 7-5. Meanwhile, the Diamondbacks' woes on the road continue in San Francisco. Arizona falling to the Giants 10-3 yesterday for a major league record 23rd straight road loss. Yikes. And visiting Buffalo, New York, to face division rival Toronto last night, the Yankees pulled off one of baseball's toughest plays for the second time this season. Watch.
Chop slowly. Oh, there's a situation at third. The throw is to first. Now they'll throw to second. Runners are hung up. They're going to come home with the throw. They have Simeon in a rundown. He's tagged out. Throw to third. It's a triple play. They pulled a triple play.
Wow, amazing. The Yankees go on to beat the Blue Jays 8-4. All right, to golf now. A delay due to heavy fog led to the suspension of yesterday's first round of the U.S. Open due to darkness, with 36 players still left on the course. Russell Henley is in the lead after shooting a 4-under 67 in the morning wave and is tied with Louis Oosthuizen, who will have to play his final two holes this morning. All right, time now for the weather. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Cairns for a check on the forecast. Bill, good morning.
Good morning, Casey. So much going on in the weather right now, so let's get into it. It is still 99 degrees in Vegas at this hour. It just dropped below 100 in Phoenix, too, so the heat continues. Yesterday, we saw record highs in many areas of California, Arizona, and today we still have 40 million people that are under these heat warnings, especially California, Southern Nevada, Utah, and in Arizona. And a little spot there in the Midwest is pretty hot today, too. So how warm will it be? We'll break record highs again today in Phoenix. Lake Havasu should be 122 degrees. It's warm again in Salt Lake City, and you get the idea, all the way up through Sacramento, record highs today. Now, the other story, we do have something in the tropics. It's trying to develop, but it hasn't really gotten its act together. This is mostly just going to be a big rainmaker. We do have tropical storm warnings in effect for areas like New Orleans, but the winds are not going to be a big deal. I'm not too worried about the path of the storm, because, you know, that's usually for more focusing on the winds. It's to the right of this path that will have the rip current threat through the weekend, right through Father's Day, and also the heavy rain threat. This area has been soaked with rain all spring long. So we have all these people from New Orleans to Mobile to Atlanta, Georgia, Birmingham, Montgomery, all in these flash flood watches. And the heaviest rains are expected to be, you know, up to 12 inches. So a foot of rain is possible through the upcoming weekend with this slow-moving storm. Especially watch out Alabama, southern Georgia, and the panhandle of Florida. And finally, we even have a severe weather threat today for 23 million people. Watch out in the Ohio Valley as we see some pretty strong storms this afternoon. So Casey, we got a little bit of everything on the map. We got some flooding, we got a tropical system, severe weather, and this epic heat wave in the west. So a lot to digest, and I hope everyone gets through it and can enjoy their weekend.
Right, I know. Stay safe this weekend, everyone. All right, Bill Cairns, thank you very much. I hope you are able to enjoy your weekend as well. Still ahead here, the Biden administration launches a new effort to fight COVID-19 and future viruses as well. We'll get to that story. But before we go to break, we want to know, why are you awake? Email us your reasons for being up and watching to waytooearly@msnbc.com, or drop me a tweet at Casey. Use the hashtag waytooearly, and we'll read some of our favorite answers coming up later on in the show.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
Welcome back. President Biden commemorating the end of slavery in the United States and making history by signing legislation to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. Biden says this will go down as one of his greatest honors as president.
Juneteenth marks both the long, hard night of slavery and subjugation and a promise of a brighter morning to come. This is a day of profound, in my view, profound weight and profound power. A day in which we remember the moral stain, the terrible toll that slavery took on the country and continues to take.
Before signing the bill yesterday, Biden gave special recognition to 94-year-old Opal Lee. She is known as the grandmother of Juneteenth because she's been advocating for over 40 years for Juneteenth to become a federal holiday.
You are an incredible woman, Ms. Opal. You really are. As a child growing up in Texas, she and her family would celebrate Juneteenth. And Juneteenth, 1939, when she was 12 years old, A white mob torched her family home. But such hate never stopped her.
Wow. All right, let's go to the coronavirus pandemic now. The Biden administration has announced a major effort to build up the country's supply of drugs used to treat COVID-19 and other viruses. The $3.2 billion plan, called the Antiviral Program for Pandemics, would speed up clinical trials of promising treatments and also accelerate the development and manufacturing of COVID-19 medications. Dr. Anthony Fauci discussed the new initiative during a White House briefing yesterday.
Vaccines clearly remain the centerpiece of our arsenal against COVID-19. However, antivirals can and are an important complement to existing vaccines, especially for individuals with certain conditions that might put them at a greater risk.
According to the Department of Health and Human Services, the program will be funded by the American Rescue Plan, which President Biden signed back in March. All right, still ahead here. The Justice Department releases previously unseen body camera footage from the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. We'll take a look at that new video. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's 5:30 here on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Casey Hunt. The House voted to repeal a 19-year-old military authorization that gave legal backing to the Iraq War. With bipartisan support and an endorsement from the White House, the House voted to repeal the 2002 authorization for the use of military force, 268 to 161. Members in both parties argued the authorization has been stretched beyond recognition to target terrorist groups that didn't even exist when the approvals were granted. A repeal would allow lawmakers to reclaim the power to permit the use of military force. The vote tees up the legislation for the Senate, where Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has already expressed his support and intention to bring it to the Senate floor later on this year. Schumer said removing the authorization would, quote, eliminate the danger of a future administration reaching back into the legal dustbin to use it as a justification for military adventurism. Senator Mitch McConnell, however, called it reckless to toss aside the authorization without, quote, answering real questions about America's own efforts in the region. Okay. Meanwhile, negotiations are still underway on police reform. Republicans now countering Democrats' request to change the criminal standard for police prosecution. That part of the working bill, which is known as Section 242, includes four crimes: obstruction of justice, theft, sexual assault, and excessive use of force. Instead of creating a new criminal standard for all four crimes, sources tell NBC News Republicans are expected to accept the Democrats' proposal for two, theft and sexual assault. As for the other remaining crimes, the sources say lawmakers will remove obstruction of justice from this section, but criminalize a much more narrow category, the falsifying of police reports. We'll keep our eye on that. And now this, the Justice Department has released new police body camera video from a D.C. police officer defending the Capitol on January 6th. It was used in the case against Thomas Webster, a former Marine and retired New York City police officer. He's wearing a red jacket and carrying a flagpole. A warning, the video that you're about to see is disturbing. My God. Webster is facing seven federal charges, including assaulting police, unlawfully entering Capitol grounds with a dangerous weapon, and civil disorder. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges. All right. Joining us now, White House editor for Politico, Sam Stein. Sam, good morning to you. Thank you so much for being up early with sure. us. It's every time I watch video like this, and, you know, it's as this investigation unfolds, I think we're going to start to see more and more of it. But I see the pictures. I was there that day. We all can see with our own eyes what happened. So as you have this coming, this new, these new vantage points, more evidence of what actually happened, we seem to have Republicans who are increasingly insisting that this didn't actually happen. Congressman Clyde having called that a tourist visit, essentially. I mean, I think we can all see very clearly there that these are not tourists. Where does this go from here? I mean, we were talking to Congressman Kinzinger yesterday on Morning Joe, and he essentially said, well, no one's actually willing to stand up and tell people the truth, which means that they're willing to believe basically anything, any conspiracy theory that shows up there.
Yeah, I think Congressman Kinzinger is right on this one. It's a remarkable the degree to which politics has warped our brains around this very simple, very disturbing event. I mean, what you witnessed there was a former cop assaulting a cop in the name of politics. That's troubling, obviously. But what we see also are politicians going to great lengths to try to excuse this type of behavior, saying it's tourist visits. They were staying within the rope lines when there's obvious video evidence that this was a deadly assault. I mean, it's like, do you not believe what your own eyes see? And so the only explanation is that our political priors have warped our brains to such a degree that at least some people are willing to excuse this type of egregious criminal action. And, you know, I don't know if there's any way to get through this, what is now becoming an intractable mess around this event, which, you know, if all of all events that this could create such, you know, gridlock. But that's what's happened here, is that we do not have the ability to vote even on a commission to study what happened leading up to this and during it. And so, you know, we're at a place where it's.
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing. And of course, I think worth pointing out yet again that Vladimir Putin, the autocratic leader of Russia, is engaged in talking about what happened in a way that lines up with the way some of these Republicans who are denying these events are talking about it. Just really stunning. Sam, let's talk for a little bit about some of the legislation winding its way. And I actually really want to talk about Joe Manchin in particular with you, because this voting rights compromise he put out there, I mean, when it first came out, I think we thought, man, there's going to be some Democratic concerns with this. But then Stacey Abrams went out there and said, yeah, I like this plan, which, of course, prompted Republicans to immediately go out and say, absolutely not, no way, no how. What are the cross pressures on Manchin right now that have driven him to this point? And do you think that pressure from his own colleagues from Democrats is starting to get to him?
It was a very Manchin-heavy day on the Hill 2 days ago. And, you know, as the people who cover the Hill probably thought the Manchin meter was off the charts. One, I do think to some degree the pressures are getting to him. I mean, I know there's this sort of conventional wisdom that he's a guy who has to tend to his home, which is distinct for a Democrat because it's so Republican-leaning. But at least to my eye, the fact that he introduced a reformed voting rights bill suggests to me that he is, in fact, feeling a little bit of heat. Because remember, the entire premise of his position on voting rights up until this week was it had to be bipartisan, that you can't overhaul voting and election laws in a strictly partisan matter. That's changed now. He's put forward a plan that he authored that will not be bipartisan, because Republicans were never going to support a voting and election overhaul that had Democratic support. So he's put together a plan that will not get Republican votes that he ostensibly will vote for. So you do think that the Democratic pressure is getting to him. That said, do these things go anywhere now? No. And I don't think it has anything to do with Stacey Abrams endorsing the bill, although it certainly didn't help. But I don't think it, you know, from a vantage point of recruiting Republicans, but I don't think they're ever going to vote in favor of this bill. It just gave them a reed to point to say, no, we can't do this because Stacey Abrams liked it. I don't know what kind of position that puts Manchin in now. You might have better thoughts on this than I do. Does that make life hard for him that he can't get these Republican votes? Does it make it easier for him to say, look, I tried? It's difficult to read this one.
Well, I think, the sense he has wanted to demonstrate to his voters back at home and also, I think, legitimately wants to be in a Senate where these bipartisan negotiations matter, where he talked to, you know, people on the other side of the aisle. He is squarely in the middle. But, you know, I think as we're all learning, it's simply not. And Joe Biden is right there with him. Right. I mean, this is not Joe Biden's Senate anymore. And I think the White House and the president have come to realize that. I'm not convinced Manchin has yet, but we might be getting there. Politico Sam Stein. Thank you. Yeah, we are. We will. Thank you so much for being up early, my friend. Really appreciate it. Have a great weekend. Still ahead here, Fallen Angels, the totally different look for one lingerie giant. Way too early, back in just a moment. Welcome back. Time now for something totally different. One toy maker is speeding into the NFT craze. Mattel will auction off three different pieces of digital art featuring its Hot Wheels vehicles as part of its Hot Wheels NFT Garage series. The one-of-a-kind works will feature classic cars from its archive, Twin Mill, Bone Shaker, and Diora 2. The auction will run for a week, and the winner will be allowed to pay in the Ethereum, in Ethereum, a cryptocurrency. This will not be the last NFT appearance for Mattel, which said in a statement that it is, quote, creating a new way for innovation and artistry to converge in the toy space and will continue to express its brands in the NFT format. Everyone trying to cash in on this particular idea. Meanwhile, an Australian company is taking car racing sky high. Its full-size, pilotless flying race car flew for the first time this week, bringing the company's dream of an electric flying car Grand Prix one step closer. Wow. According to developers, the aircraft design is based on a Formula One car and has a greater thrust-to-weight ratio than an F-15 fighter jet. It's going to be put to the test during a remotely piloted race later on this year. Very cool. Vaguely terrifying. All right, now there's this. Victoria's Secret is attempting to rebrand. The lingerie giant swapping its signature model Angels for a group of diverse women who are known for their career accomplishments. Soccer star Megan Rapinoe, actress Priyanka Chopra Jonas, and 17-year-old Chinese-American skier Eileen Gu are among the seven women selected for the new VS Collective, under the leadership of a revamped executive team and board of directors. The VS Collective will advise the brand and appear in ads. The move comes after the company faced years of scrutiny for promoting an outdated idea of femininity and recent revelations about a misogynistic corporate culture. CEO Martin Waters told the New York Times, quote, "When the world was changing, we were too slow to respond. We needed to stop being about what men want and be about what women want." Guess we'll see if this actually works for them or not. All right, still ahead here, the significance behind Justice Amy Coney Barrett's vote to uphold the Affordable Care Act. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Justice Amy Coney Barrett's vote to uphold the Affordable Care Act defied claims by Democrats that she was guaranteed to strike it down. Healthcare, and more specifically Obamacare, was a top issue used to oppose her confirmation. During hearings, Democrats posted photos of people who would allegedly lose their health care if Barrett was confirmed. Then Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said, quote, "The American people should make no mistake. A vote by any senator for Judge Amy Coney Barrett is a vote to strike down the Affordable Care Act." Then Democratic vice presidential nominee and Senator Kamala Harris released a statement that claimed, quote, "Republicans are desperate to get Judge Barrett confirmed before the Supreme Court takes up this case in November, and millions of Americans will suffer for their power play." And an email from the campaign of Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had the subject line, "Confirming Amy Coney Barrett will be the end of the Affordable Care Act." Obviously, that's not what happened. The Supreme Court also handed down another ruling yesterday in a high-profile religious freedom case. The justices sided with a Catholic Social Services agency in Philadelphia that argued its religious beliefs prevent it from working with same-sex foster parents. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the city went too far in imposing its anti-discrimination law on the agency. Joining us now, Frederick Lawrence, distinguished lecturer at Georgetown Law and the secretary and CEO of the Phi Beta Kappa Society. Thank you so much for being with us this morning, sir. Really appreciate it.
Good morning.
Let's start with the ACA. This was something, right, they essentially said, okay, you were never hurt by this law, so you have absolutely no standing to sue on this basis. Therefore, we're not going to move forward with this. It does feel like this is likely the end of these types of cases, only because it's hard to argue that there's anyone that could bring such a case because of that mandate being zeroed out. But I'm curious if you think that there would be another route, or if there are going to be additional challenges to this. I mean, Obamacare is so embedded in our society now.
That's right. It does feel as if this is the end of the road. This is the third of the Obamacare challenges. The court upheld it each time, the first time 5-4, next time 6-3, and this time 7-2. I think the the size of the victory surprised people. Now, as you mentioned, be careful. This says less than people think it does. The challenge was to the constitutionality of Obamacare, and the court never reached that. The court said, just as you suggested, Casey, that the states involved, the individuals involved, were not hurt by the constitutional violations they allege, and therefore they have no standing. But it does look as if no one is going to have standing to challenge this. So by a 7-2 vote, Justice Breyer, one of the most experienced people up there, put this coalition together of seven votes, leaving only the two most conservative, or two of the most conservative justices, Justices Gorsuch and Alito, who said, sure, they're standing and they wanted to strike the law down. But 7-2, and most significant, both Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, two appointments by President Trump, joined those seven justices saying that the law is going to remain in place.
Yeah, because we ran through some of what people said about Amy Coney Barrett during her confirmation. Were you surprised by her vote here? What do you think that tells us about what kind of justice she's going to be?
I think so far she appears to be positioning herself along with Justice Kavanaugh towards the center of this court. Now, make no mistake, center does not mean moderate. We have a court right now with six conservative justices, three extremely conservative justices. That's Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch. And then three conservative justices. That's Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett. And then, of course, the three liberals, Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. But Justice Barrett is not over there all the way on the right. She does appear to be more towards the, let's call it, mainstream conservative than the extreme conservative on the court. Way too early to start making statements like this, but we're starting to see the early signs of what her judicial career on the court's going to be. And look, for guys like me, this is high season. You know, we're watching the court make all these decisions right now, so we're really watching how the court's going to formulate.
Yeah, I appreciate the way too early pun, intended or not. And thank you for getting
that was
so
for
early
you.
To help us
that
understand
was for you.
A little bit better. I really appreciate it. Frederick Lawrence, thank you so much. Enjoy your weekend, sir. Frederick's book is Punishing Hate, Bias Crimes Under American Law. All right. Earlier on in the show, we asked all of you, why are you awake? Beverly writes, it's my official last day of school, bringing a close to more than a year of adapting to a new way to teach and surviving a day at a time. Sing it. Congratulations. Enjoy your summer. One viewer tweeted, they're up early because democracy. I'm an NYC early voting poll worker and polls open early today. That's awesome. Quintus shared this photo. It's the Maryland High School baseball playoffs and I'm up making breakfast for champions. Go Alfleton baseball. Indeed. Good luck. That looks delicious. Another viewer tweeted, I'm up way too early because my brain wants to get this day over with so I can go home and enjoy Father's Day weekend. I hear that. Thank you guys for watching.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.